Hello, everyone, and welcome to Transitional Justice on ThinkTech Hawaii. I'm your host today, Laura Rubio, Communications Officer at Project Expedite Justice, sitting in for Jay Fidel. Joining me today is our guest, Catherine Weisel, expert investigator with Justice Rapid Response. Today, we're going to talk about the international support provided to war crimes prosecutions in Uganda, East Africa, after the extensive civil conflict between a militia group, the Lord's Resistance Army, LRA, and the Ugandan authorities. Welcome, Catherine.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here today, Catherine. So to start us off, I would like you to introduce yourself if you have anything to say apart from what I just said. And then to please, can you bring us into context for our discussion today? So start by explaining shortly what the conflict was in Uganda and what the situation was.
Yeah, sure, Laura, thanks. Well, I suppose I'll start with a little bit of background about me. I've had a number of years in law enforcement in Australia and specialising in investigations. So I've been involved in a number of investigations locally, major crime, counterterrorism and that sort of thing. I participated as an international expert as part of an international team who was deployed to Uganda to provide some support to some war crimes prosecutions that the Ugandan authorities were undertaking. That support, I guess, was in light of the Ugandan authorities realising that they wanted to actually prosecute some offenders responsible for or allegedly responsible for a number of crimes that occurred throughout the conflict between the LRA and the Ugandan authorities. And this conflict essentially started in the 80s, in the mid-80s, where various militia groups amalgamated and formed the Lord's Resistance Army, which was essentially a right-wing quasi-Christian group, if you like. And they operated in northern Uganda around the border region of South Sudan. So that conflict went on until the early 2000s when a number of leaders of the LRA were essentially detained, and some of them were detained in neighbouring countries, including DRC, so the Democratic Republic of Congo, and some leaders remain outstanding as well. So as the Ugandan authorities sort of stabilised the region, they did capture one of the leaders and have considered that the prosecution of that person is vital to demonstrating their commitment to international international criminal justice and transitional justice. And they also sought the support from international organisations such as JRR. And the International Criminal Court has also been involved in one of the prosecutions of the alleged perpetrators or now convicted perpetrator within the LRA.
So this conflict started in the 80s. And when was it that the authorities started bringing in help from outside and looking into prosecuting the crimes?
So in 2004, the Ugandan authorities sought support from the International Criminal Court. And so the International Criminal Court began an investigation separate to the one I provided support in. So over a number of years, various investigative inquiries were carried out by the ICC and experts attached to the ICC in collaboration with Ugandan authorities. And then in 2015, one of their suspects was captured or turned himself in, and he's subsequently been prosecuted by the ICC. In addition to that, another leader within the LRA was captured in the DRC and handed over to Ugandan authorities, and they've taken on that prosecution and investigation themselves. I suppose realising some of the gaps in their own resources with respect to the prosecution of international war crimes, they have sought assistance from international organisations, including Justice Rapid Response, who then provided a team of experts to support the local authorities, so essentially assist in capacity building with the local authorities in terms of their investigative techniques, witness protection mechanisms and prosecutorial processes as well. And amongst the team, we also had psychosocial expert too, to provide that support from a, particularly from a witness, you know, witness-based perspective.
So the international assistance came in along with the national process and investigation that started by the prosecution, but all of this came in after the ICC started their investigations toward the Uganda case?
Yes, the specific prosecution that my team and I provided support with was after the ICC sort of matter. Although the detainment and arrest of the suspect occurred some years earlier. So, you know, there have been a number of challenges, of course, for the local authorities, notwithstanding one of those being the identification of witnesses and trying to track witnesses down, bearing in mind we're dealing with a conflict that's lasted sort of over a 20-year period. And so, yeah, there have been a number of challenges associated with that.
Yeah, of course, and starting the investigation, so such a long time after the events happened must be very hard for the investigators. But I'm also curious, as an investigator helping specifically the local authorities, how is the relationship with the investigations of war crimes being done on an international level by the ICC?
Sorry, how's the relationship with the ICC, you mean, or in terms
of... Yeah, between the cases and in terms of the investigation.
Yeah, so so the matter that I was involved in, we were entirely separate to the ICC. So I didn't sort of have anything to do with their investigation. But I know that when the ICC did come in and investigate certain things in Uganda, I mean, Uganda certainly sought their assistance in the first place as part of their commitment to the Rome Statute. And that's when the ICC... you know, committed to that investigation to support, I suppose, the Ugandan authorities' commitment to the Rome Statute and their attempts at bringing justice to the accused people and those responsible for a number of atrocities during the conflict.
Okay, wonderful, thank you. And then at what point in the transition to peace did these investigations start and did you come in to work in Uganda?
So a number of inquiries and investigative sort of tasks had already been carried out by the Ugandan authorities prior to the team that I was part of came into it. And I guess what they determined during the process of the legal process, you know, of the prosecution, was that they had a number of gaps. Now, specifically in relation to the sexual and gender-based violence offences that were committed against a number of women and children during the conflict. So it was within that context that my team provided specific support around the sexual and gender-based violence associated with the conflict. And then the team came in and provided that specific expert advice, sat alongside the local authorities responsible for the investigation, as well as the local prosecutors. Local sort of witness protection mechanisms were put in place, supporting local authorities to actually administer that. Then as well as, of course, the psychosocial support provided to the witnesses. So sometimes witnesses had to be re-interviewed as part of our review of the case, really specific to the gender and sexual-based violence. So that was sort of quite a challenging moment as well, given that we were dealing with very sensitive issues and extremely traumatic circumstances for the victims. But it was necessary in order to make sure that the most relevant evidence was put before the court for this process and for the prosecution. You know, the Ugandan authorities were very much aware of the need to employ justice mechanisms for those involved, not only for the witnesses and victims, but also ensure that they were demonstrating fairness and judicial process for the accused person too.
Yeah, that must be very delicate because you don't want to re-victimize by having to do interviews, victim interviews again after so many years. So how did you go about that and helping the authorities? And also, did your team do the interviews directly, or were you just helping the authorities to manage the situation?
Yeah, so our main role was simply to provide some advice and guidance in relation to some of the gaps in evidence that might exist with respect to the specific charges that had already been laid against the accused person. So we just provided support and guidance in terms of reviewing the evidence to see if there was any additional lines of inquiry that could be carried out. And that included, in some cases, obtaining additional witness evidence, in some cases, pursuing some forensic lines of inquiries, and in some cases, making sure that the facts were actually put in such a way that met the each specific offence. So there was a lot of support provided to each member of the team, of the local team. Our role wasn't to take lead of any of the witness interviews, but simply to support the locals. And the locals actually drove the process themselves. So the local authorities drove the process with our capacity building assistance.
Okay, so the assistance was about how to go ahead with the interviews without re-victimizing and taking care of the specific situations, and what other main topics were part of your capacity building?
Yeah, that's right. So it was very much about identifying the gaps in the evidence that may have existed, and then looking at ways to best re-interview or interview new witnesses as well in a sensitive way. So taking on board, I guess my training from Australia as well as internationally, approaching witnesses, particularly witnesses who are either witnesses to or victims of sexual and gender-based violence, taking those approaches from an international experience and applying them to the local circumstances. So this case was very much about I guess local victims, but with international expectations on the prosecution, expectations on the gathering of evidence. Our role was really to support the local authorities achieve the highest standards of evidence gathering that could be achieved under the circumstances, and making sure that the case was accountable. I suppose a little bit of background to this as well. The LRA within the conflict were not the only ones being accused of sort of violence. There was a lot of distrust, I guess, levelled at the Ugandan authorities as a result of accusations against Ugandan authorities from some years before. So that too had to be navigated, particularly with relationships with local communities, had to be navigated with the relationships with the local non-government organisations that were very much about supporting the victims from a psychosocial perspective. So there are a lot of things that we I suppose negotiated with. Particularly that relationship building and bridging the gap between misunderstanding and of the judicial process, as well as getting the local NGOs on board to provide additional support to witnesses and the like.
And I imagine that's also the reason why there were international expectations on these local processes, because we were building trust again after a war. And that's why we're covering these local processes under a transitional justice subject, right? So I imagine the expectations were quite high, and perhaps the authorities were working in a way that they were not used to. So can you talk a bit more about that and about how it was working with authorities and bringing something new to a process that, well, they're the experts in, they're the nationals, and they have been prosecuting crimes in a normal, not normal, in a local sense for many years. So coming in as an international expert to help must include some hurdles.
I suppose initially, and I was deployed on a couple of missions here for this particular matter. So initially, the first mission was all about really building those relationships and getting to know the local authorities. As Uganda, I guess was a British colony, a lot of the systems in place were very much British systems, so traditionally British systems. So the judicial system in Uganda is very similar to that in the UK, very similar to that in Australia. So there are a lot of things that didn't need, that weren't challenging. There was already an understanding and a similarity in the processes that were undertaken. So that helped the relationship building. But I guess some of the challenges, certainly Uganda, is different, although they are a democratic republic. They do have some different governance issues around them. They have had a history of deficiencies in their democratic processes. They have had sort of deficiencies in their human rights processes. So a lot of those things had to be navigated as well with our relationship. And just, I suppose, demonstrating from the team that I was part of, it was important for us to demonstrate rather that we weren't there to take over. We weren't there to tell them what to do. We were simply there to sit alongside them and develop their capacity. So it was, I guess, with a long-term view that this was not going to be the first local prosecution of this nature. It was hoped that our mission would develop their capacity in order for them to take on any future matters of such serious nature as well. And that was really what drove us in the mission, and to make sure that from a transitional justice perspective, that the victims and witnesses involved in this matter were, that their voice was heard, and that they were given a chance to actually be part of the process, which is so often a criticism of, international matters where victims and witnesses are not heard.
Thank you, Catherine. That's very good that the system, and probably very helpful that the system is so similar to the one that you're used to from Australia. But I wonder what other challenges come with investigating and prosecuting war crimes in a local jurisdiction specifically. So what else were, aside from what we have already talked about, in terms of finding the gaps in the evidence, what other challenges did you help the local authorities with?
Yeah, so I can absolutely talk to that. So I guess one of the main challenges was with this particular case, as I mentioned, was the historical nature of it. Now, although Uganda has a very similar judicial process and makeup to, countries I'm used to working in, they also have some resource restrictions, and that, I suppose, comes down to modernization, technology, funding, and those sort of things. So that was sort of one of the significant challenges, the digital collection and retention of evidence. So we supported the Ugandan authorities with laying out that evidence where they were able to actually store it and implement some data management processes that they didn't previously have. The other thing too was the significant, I guess there are some significant cultural challenges. Dealing with a matter that involved a conflict that essentially displaced thousands of people and caused significant violence to a number of communities, and as I said earlier, sometimes that those accusations of violence were leveled at the Ugandan authorities too. So going into a rural area where the majority of the victims were was a challenge in and of itself, and employing some of those witness protection mechanisms. Many of the victims and witnesses also came from rural and remote communities with significant social and cultural barriers to actually being open about what's happened to them in a conflict. And the issues around sexual violence are also bring a lot of shame to communities. So that was really difficult for them to actually talk about, let alone give mm-hmm. evidence about. So that was certainly one of the challenges that we had to speak to the witnesses about and help them understand the process, the judicial process, so that they could come to terms with how they were going to be part of it. And that was really important for them to understand the process, to trust the process so that they would feel confident participating in the process. As well as that, I guess, because the victims were from these rural and remote communities, the accused people were also from the same communities. So there was also a level of threat towards the victims and witnesses in giving evidence during any trial. So that's a real challenge for any witness and victim, you know, around the world. But in these rural and remote communities where local authorities perhaps aren't necessarily the first go-to people when you are in trouble, that's an additional challenge, and we certainly saw that in this case. So that's why we had the witness protection expert on our team as well to provide support in that respect.
Of course.
So I suppose, I was going to say, if I could sum up the challenges, I would say modernization of processes, witness and victim protection, and the collection of evidence from such a long time ago. So actually identifying the relevant witnesses and collecting the forensic evidence from historical matters. And, you know, that's always a challenge again, globally too.
Yeah, of course. And many times in international war crimes, international crimes or war crime situations where it takes longer for a justice process to start because it requires a transition to peace and hopefully an ending of the conflict, or at least a change in the conflict for these investigations to be able to start. So on that note, I have two questions. One is, can you also talk a bit about the understanding of what war crimes are and the relationship of these processes to the historical process that the country as a whole was living during this investigation? So yeah. That would be either...
Sorry, go on.
Go ahead. To explain the question, to if you can talk about the understanding of war crimes within the local jurisdiction and also within the local communities, and also the understanding of the relationship between these and then the transition the country is going through, the historical moment.
In essence, whenever there's been an instance of accusation of war crimes in a country, ideally it's the country themselves that takes responsibility for that investigation, that prosecution, regardless of who's responsible for it. And so that was a big step of itself for Uganda to take responsibility for one of those prosecutions. The other thing too was the, I guess, commitment to the Rome Statute, which is an international commitment to human rights and ensuring that, I guess, establishing a framework, a legislative framework around war crimes, crimes against humanity, you know, those quite frankly ghastly crimes that occur often during conflict, and obviously war crimes specific to that. And we're talking about this systemic sexual abuse of people, systemic eradication of communities and groups of people. So it's not just necessarily one offence of murder that's been alleged in the context of a war crimes. It's usually a systemic process where one group of aggressors attacks a group of innocent people, usually through abhorrent violence like rape, like murder of, you know, all parents, and then kidnapping of all children to turn them into soldiers. So they're the sort of significant crimes that we were dealing with. Abhorrent crimes where a number of witnesses were left with, you know, really awful physical and emotional scars, having witnessed them, having been victimized by them, and they're the sort of I guess crimes that we really do want to make sure are investigated properly, and that people are held accountable for those crimes as well. And that's part of the mission of transitional justice, really, to hold people accountable to those crimes and provide support to those that have been victimised by them, and provide support to those that choose to prosecute and pursue justice for the victims, so that peace can be built. Ultimately, without justice, peace can't really be achieved. And that's, I guess, the main idea of transitional justice.
Yeah, exactly. And that also brings us back to my question from the beginning, which is the relation of these investigations and prosecutions by the local authorities with what was the investigation by the International Criminal Court. So the relevance and the importance of the country taking responsibility over the investigation and the prosecution of some of these crimes also says a lot about their jurisdiction and their ability to continue the transition to peace and towards a democratic and peaceful society, which of course needs justice to function. And that's where international assistance is so important, to bring that small knowledge that the local authorities may not have, and that technical assistance to be able to guarantee that these prosecutions are successful, right? So that's why your work
Absolutely.
Is so important. Thank you very much for doing it. And it's very interesting to hear it. I hope most, if not all, of the prosecutions went well, and are at least some of them finished?
Yeah, look, the ICC have finished some of theirs, and they've issued a number of arrest warrants for other people who are still outstanding. And the Ugandan authorities continue their prosecution as well. So that's an ongoing process.
Wonderful. Well, Catherine, thank you very much. Is there anything else that you would like to make sure that our listeners learn about the situation in Uganda and the international assistance to the investigations by the local authorities before we end for today?
No, look, thanks so much for having me. I think it's important for everybody to realise that there is a lot of work that goes into this from an international community perspective. And without the international community and the support from experts around the world, sometimes international or transitional justice is not achieved. So that's really important that the community, the international community, gets on board.
Yeah, of course. Well, thank you very much, Catherine. Again, this is Laura Rubio from Project Expedite Justice on transitional justice from ThinkTech Hawaii. We've been talking with Catherine Weissel about the investigations of war crimes in Uganda. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you so much for watching ThinkTech Hawaii. If you like what we do, please like us and click the subscribe button on YouTube and the follow button on Vimeo. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, and donate to us at thinktechhawaii.com. Mahalo.